Department of Transportation, OEM, State Parks, and many other agencies, especially local agencies, to educate and inform folks. But it's an uphill battle. There are still many communities that, as Senator Johnson said, the economics are scary, and the money to do community education is hard to come by. I'm sure if you have been to the coast, you have seen these signs. I know I have. When I stay in a hotel or motel, I actually go out and find the evacuation route and the high ground nearby and make sure that my three-day emergency kit is in my trunk. But I'm a very paranoid person. So.
And you might want to make
paranoid.
Might want to make that 2 weeks. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Dr. Riley?
No, I'm okay. Just Mr. Riley.
All right, Mr. Riley. Last week when we had that tsunami warning.
Yes, ma'am.
Were you part of it?
Representative Nelson, Chair Boone, and Verger, yes, I was. I was the media representative for our department.
Follow-up, please, sir.
That caught me off guard, certainly, because I don't live at the coast. But were you greatly concerned?
Representative Nelson, Chairs Verger and Boone. No, because this event, it was an earthquake in the Kuril Islands between Russia and Japan. It was a magnitude 7.9, I think, finally realized as an 8.2. Mm-hmm. Those tend to be, they are large enough to generate a tsunami, usually have to be above a 7.5 magnitude earthquake to generate a tsunami, depending on how the ground is breaking as well. But those events tend to be localized in nature. Since about 1970, there have been 16 to 18 false alarms along the Pacific Northwest coast for tsunamis. So it becomes very difficult to interest people in a tsunami warning when they're issued. Ours was a tsunami advisory. The warning was issued for Alaska and for Hawaii, and it was pulled about an hour after the event took place. So, scientists were able to determine that no tsunami had been generated, and they're getting better and better at this thing. But still, you know, 18 events, in the last 35 years or so where they've all been false alarms does tend to, you know, make people think Chicken Little.
Well, and Chair Verger and Boone and committee members, really what you have in these situations are that there was a tsunami that occurred. A tsunami is simply a wave that's above, that balancing of the volume of water. It was maybe 40 centimeters, which means it was about 20 inches or so, and so it was not significant enough to want to force the local communities to want to react to that. That's why it was an advisory. Where if you have a warning, they're saying this wave is going to be high enough that there may be some damage. And so when we have false alarms, the alarm usually comes from you can't easily with the science go, okay, this one is going to generate a 3-meter wave, and we know that that's going to happen. Sometimes they don't generate waves that high. So the false alarm comes from how do you decide when is it time to issue a warning or evacuation, and the cost and that goes along with those kind of actions, as you all know. And it does also bring about the issue of then if people respond to things that don't seem to really have happened, the next time you have a fire alarm, everyone sits at their desk and goes, okay, well, nothing happened that time. I'm not going to bother. So it is a thin line that you have to be very careful with that.
Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
The Crescent City gets hit a lot. They had an alarm that people didn't take seriously, and they had a fairly large wave. During 64, they were wiped out. But recently, there was an event in Crescent City. Are you familiar about the recent one?
Senator Morissette.
Very high wave.
Verger, and November 15th.
Yeah.
The same area of the Kuril Islands experienced a magnitude 8.3 earthquake. Once again, a warning was issued, an advisory for the Pacific Northwest was issued. But in this instance, Crescent City had over $1 million worth of damage from a wave that was 6 to 8 feet high.
Wow.
And in Oregon, Port Orford saw a 4-foot surge, but no damage was mentioned. So that didn't get a lot of attention. But it still did an incredible amount of damage for an event that took place 5,000 miles away.
Wow.
Go ahead.
Not only do we get Cascadia subductions on earthquakes, if you're a geologist, you're really excited about the fact that we get every other type of earthquake that is possible in the world. We get intraplate earthquakes. The Nisqually earthquake that occurred February 28, 2001, that some people may have felt, that was up near Olympia. That was a magnitude 5.7 earthquake. No, 6.7. Magnitude 6.7 earthquake. That was an intraplate earthquake. And you can see it's part of where the Cascadia subduction zone is actually part of the Pacific plate is diving under North America and breaking up. And we also get crustal earthquakes. Crustal earthquakes are probably the most dangerous in terms of destructive ability within the western part of Oregon. Although, if you look at this map, going back to 1841, you can see that crustal earthquakes occur everywhere in Oregon.
Wow.
The farther east you get, you're pretty safe. But Klamath Falls, that big black blob down at the bottom of the screen, has seen hundreds, if not thousands, of earthquakes following the 1993 magnitude 5.9 and magnitude 6 earthquakes. Since 1970, the Pacific Northwest has had over 17,000 earthquakes. In fact, it used to be thought that Oregon was the place that Californians would come to get away from earthquakes. And now, with the Cascadia subduction zone, which we've really only known about its destructive abilities for about the last 20 years, we know that it's not as much fun to be in the Pacific Northwest. Some special events that have occurred here. In 1993, in Klamath Falls, I mentioned that, $10 million in damage. The Scotts Mills earthquake, a magnitude 5.6 earthquake, a relatively moderate earthquake, but $30 million in damage in the Portland metro areas. And the Capitol Rotunda in Salem damaged here as well. The giant statue on top of the rotunda rotated, actually, about 3/4 of an inch or so. An example of some of the work that we have done in locating the Portland Hills Fault, a fault that we believe has the possibility of generating up to a magnitude 6.5 earthquake that runs right through the heart of Portland. For example, the magnitude 6.7 earthquake that occurred in Northridge in the Los Angeles area did about $44 billion worth of damage. And that's an estate that is much better prepared for an earthquake than Oregon.
Can I break you right there and have you explain that in brief? Why is California much better prepared?
Representative Chair Boone, Chair Verger, California has been at this for 100 years, following the 1906 great San Francisco earthquake. They get lots and lots more earthquakes than we do in Oregon. Mm-hmm. In fact, Washington State gets about 6 times more earthquakes than we do in Oregon. Unfortunately, we've got this giant earthquake fault sitting off our coast that when it happens is really going to be something. But the other thing, because California gets lots and lots of earthquakes, all of their bad buildings have either fallen down or been seismically retrofitted. And they spend millions and millions of dollars on mitigation. You know, in Oregon, we're kind of slow to catch up. We've only known for about the last 20 years about the Cascadia subduction zone and its destructive abilities. We don't get the large destructive earthquakes that they do in California. And we don't get the shakers that they do in California that are constant reminders there that you need to be prepared.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Here is a photograph of our scientists actually putting their fingers on the Portland Hills Fault. This occurred a few years ago. This is, and you can sort of see it, these were sediments that were laid down in the Missoula floods about 15,000 years ago. They've been bent about 6 feet subsequently, which means that at some point in the last 10,000 years or so, there was about a magnitude 6 to 6.5 earthquake that occurred in the Portland area that was able to warp these sediments.
Madam Chair, was that picture taken when they were boring the hole for the light rail through the hill? Because I have talked to an engineer that said he was there and they found that in the middle of that mountain.
Senator George, Chairs Verger and Boone, this was taken at a middle school in Milwaukee, the Rowe Middle School. So, and this was actually the first time that our geologists had put their fingers on the fault.
Do you guys have any record of that discovery when they bored the hole? Okay, you are. Yeah, because the engineer was very concerned that there be an immediate alert system for anyone who might be on a light rail going through the tunnel.
Thank you. Now, the Missoula flood made many different kinds of deposits, and I understand Beaverton is a bowl of jelly underneath.
Senator Morissette, Chairs Verger and Boone, that is correct. There are soft sediments in the Tualatin Valley, which makes it amplify the effects of earthquakes.
Now, what about the 13 bridges that go across the rivers? How many of them are going to fall down?
Senator Morissette, you're not being fair.
There are some bridges at risk, and I know we've done some work. I hope we do them all.
So you don't know how many.
Representative Schaffler.
Actually, thank you, Madam Chair. They have done some seismic retrofitting to the Markham Bridge, I believe, has had some put in it, and the bridge across the Willamette, I think it's the Abernathy Bridge at Oregon City, that's had some done. So I just visually see this. And I personally have been involved in seismic retrofitting in several buildings in Portland. As a matter of fact, I saw one of the projects I worked on years ago, one of the high-rises there. And my question about, I believe our response preparation is lacking, responding to the eventual catastrophe. But our building codes, I believe, are conscious and reflect our awareness of our situation here in Oregon. Am I correct in thinking that?
Representative Schaffler and Chairs Verger and Boone, building codes for new buildings are required to be built up to code, and the new code that was adopted a couple of years ago, the IBC, the International Building Code, incorporates the USGS probabilistic earthquake maps in it and identifies most of Western Oregon to be in the higher seismic risk zones. So yes, new buildings are required. However, old buildings, of which there are lots of old buildings, and particularly what we call URMs or unreinforced masonry buildings, unless you're going to go in and do some major changing you're not required to bring those up to code. And that is a worry, and that's a concern. And actually, we can talk a little bit about that if we get a chance with talking about Senate Bill 2 and the work that's been done on identifying some of those buildings.
Yeah, thank you. And I just will reiterate, too, the committee in the interim did quite a bit of work on this, and Dr. McConnell could probably provide you with that report of what they're doing all around the state, not just on the coast, to evaluate and assess public buildings that need retrofitting. So,
Representative Schaffler, chairs, Verger and Boone, you are correct. If you travel on the lower deck of the Markham Bridge through Portland, you can see the steel reinforced cabling that exists. And the city of Portland has some pretty strict regulations on when you rehab buildings, for example, in the Pearl District. They have to be brought up to seismic code. And that's one of the things with the old Myron Frank building also was it was going to be $20 million to seismically retrofit that building before they could do the renovation on it. So there are some communities that have taken these rules and reinforced them and made them stronger. The city of Portland, when they are rehabbing one of their bridges, they usually do a seismic upgrade on them. But there are literally thousands of bridges through the state, and it's a very, very daunting task to do them all.
I think we're going to hear that all throughout this committee. That will be doubly depressing because if you did it right, how much it would all cost to really prepare everybody and or every building and everything in our state. So go ahead.
Sure. Thank you.
It seems to be everyone's answer to our problems.
This is a landslide from 1996 in the Portland Hills, shot by a gentleman riding in the back of a pickup truck.
Awesome.
You can only assume he was 20 years old.
Had to be a guy.
Wow.
Landslides tend to be one of the more dramatic, chronic problems that we face in Oregon. When we get the floods, we get landslides. When we get lots of rain, we get landslides. And in fact, in 1996, when the federal government reimbursed Oregon for flooding and landslides to the tune of about $100 million, $70 million of that went to rehab roads, bridges, and structures for landslides. So, you know, even in years when we aren't getting lots of flooding, landslides tend to be a very chronic problem. We all know of the problems on Highway 101 that tend to happen on a very cyclical basis. Here, an apartment complex in Oregon City from 2005, when we were having so much rain, and in fact, the 9 buildings in Oregon City at this apartment complex were condemned, and hundreds of people were relocated because of this. And most recently, Highway 35. It's my understanding that about $20 million was spent to get the highway reopened, and now there's talk of rerouting the highway to the tune of probably tens of millions of dollars, so that these chronic problems that continue to happen along Highway 35 won't happen anymore. Along with landslides, coastal erosion tends to be a chronic yearly problem in Oregon. Here, homes in the Nesquin area are being emergency riprapped because of erosion. Some of these huge winter storm events can take feet, if not yards, away from bluffs where houses have been built. We know that estimates are that since a study in 2000 found that costs on the Pacific itself are about $100 million in property and housing losses, plus $70 million to communities on an ongoing basis. That's over about a 20-year period. And Oregon certainly sees its share of erosion. and it's isolated. You can't say for sure that this community is going to lose 150 feet of bluffs this year, or this one's going to lose 50 feet. It's not an exact science. For example, here are some houses in Pacific City that were riprapped in the 70s, and today the riprap is covered with sand and the houses are actually being covered with sand dunes, while down the beach the homes are being eroded away again. So you just never know. Our state parks are affected by this as well. Here's a great example at Cape Lookout State Park. This is the shower and bath facility at the campground at Cape Lookout State Park. This is in 1999. We had huge storm events then. This facility actually used to sit about 100 yards away from the beach. Storms overtopped the low dunes that were there and were threatening the campgrounds. Our department, working with state parks, came up with a very innovative idea to build an artificial dune and cobble beach, one of the first that was ever done in the world. And to this day, the beach has this berm and cobble beach has worked wonderfully. It's actually been overtopped a couple of times with large storms, but the cost was minimal compared to riprapping the whole beach. So there are ways that we can look at coastal erosion that are different, kind of out of the box.
Anything to add?
I think the point there to be made is that there's always the trade-off between, do you try to mitigate by riprapping or seawalls or something that's a very rigid structure, or are there other ways that you might be able to mitigate that you still can save part of the area but not make it quite so intrusive or invasive? And so it's something that we really need to think about on how we're going to deal with the entire beach and the entire oceanfront.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Is that Wilbur Turnack's seagrass, dune grass?
European grass.
I was afraid someone would ask that question, and you'd have to ask state parks.
Elmas mollis, that's native. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't think state parks would put the European grass in.
Okay. Wilbur.
James, I have a question about that and that process. Is that something that's, and this is the only one right now, the only example of this kind of artificial beach or berm?
Fairboon and Verger, that is correct. This is the only one that's been built in North America that I'm aware of.
And is somebody keeping track of it so that we can look back on it and say this is a very viable option?
Chair Boone and Verger, yes. This is constantly monitored by our department.
Okay.
And we're hoping that it's a model for the rest of the coast instead of having everything riprapped at some point.
That's really hopeful.
I mean, you walk along any beach, Lincoln City, for example, walk along the beach there, and you look up and, you know, every 10th house is hanging over the edge. Yeah. So it tends to be a real problem.
And just as a forewarning, we've been going off on tangents here all day, but it's been very interesting. So about 10 more minutes, will you be able to finish your... Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Volcanic eruptions, another geologic hazard. Here's a nice sequence, if you're a volcanologist, of actually an earthquake occurring, triggering the largest landslide in recorded history, which then triggered the eruption of Mount St. Helens. We live in only one of a handful of states with active volcanoes. And here's a before and after, the smaller picture before Mount St. Helens today. Once again, an incredible geologic hazard. And Mount St. Helens is not the only volcano that has erupted in the last couple of hundred years. We've actually had an eruption in 1916, Mount Lassen in Northern California, just before Lewis and Clark came through in 1806, Mount Hood had an event. So in terms of geologic time, it's just a blink of the eye. And this work, the monitoring of volcanoes, is done by the United States Geologic Survey Cascades Volcano Observatory. And we work with them very closely in the work on volcanoes in Oregon. And we hope at some point our state
yes
is able to yell more than help, help.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much. Yes, we do have some time for questions. Oh, you have more. I'm sorry.
If you can't get to sleep at night, we do have some publications written in layman's terms on volcanoes, earthquakes. We have handy brochures to take with you to the coast when you go on tsunamis. And we have a wealth of information on our website, OregonGeology.com.
And just so you know, that my background, when I first went up to University of Washington, my first natural resource class was in geology. And I nearly became on that track. But oceanography grabbed me, and tell the story about the Calypso on the dock, which I won't put on the record, but that's how I got into politics.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Please. What would be helpful in your brochure is a list of hotels that are several hundred feet up off the coast for paranoid people like me, and I'd be a great patron of those establishments. Especially if they have a very well-stocked pantry and bar in case we're stuck there for 2 weeks.
Well, just for your peace of mind, the coastal communities are really getting all over this. We've had several, and this is something that has happened some years ago, and I think 4 years ago, and it was as simple as a door-to-door, watch out for your neighbor, and the restaurants and hotels along the coast, especially those in the inundation zone, and regular training and evacuation training. And out of all that, the people who were the most successful in getting out of the inundation zone quickly were the grade school kids. Because they stood in line and they were quiet and they went up the hill when they were told to. So, yeah, at least in Seaside that happened.
Mm-hmm. And you have to believe that part of that is because they do regular drills mm-hmm. in their school, and there's nothing like being able to recognize a process and know how to react to it. And that is a very strong advocacy for regular drills of any kind. So,
and it has a secondary effect, and this is just from personal knowledge, at least in the Seaside area, the people who take it very seriously, the block monitors, are also watching out for those neighbors in those blocks that they're assigned. For there are a lot of elderly people and a lot of people with health problems, and they have kind of taken it upon themselves to visit these people regularly anyway, not just when there's a problem, a disaster threat. So it has helped a lot, and so we hope that this continues, and it's a good thing. And it's kind of neighbor to neighbor. It's a very good program. Any questions? Oh, thank you. Senator George.
Geology helped me a few months ago by providing a map of a high liquefaction area. The problem with that map is it's accurate because it's a great big alluvial fan that was caused by a silt that settled in there in the Missoula flood. Mm-hmm. The only problem is we're about to build a bypass on top of that. And I've gone out and looked at that, and I'm thinking nobody would build on at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be the last place you would direct. But I think this thing is moving forward. Is there anything that we should be thinking about to say, you really don't want to build there? Because this is 80 feet above the water where this highway would go, and it's water on both sides, a creek and a river, and a high liquefaction area.
Senator George and co-chairs, yes, that area that you're speaking of, the thing that we do when we identify the areas, whether it's the liquefaction areas for earthquake hazards, or if we're talking about the tsunami hazard zones, where the possible inundation would be, etc., is it gives
it gives the decision makers, and it gives construction, it gives industry, it gives businesses a chance then to know, okay, where are the zones or where are the where you might have a problem. Now, there may be a problem there. That doesn't mean you can't engineer around it. And then therein is the challenge. And certainly, and you know, that's certainly out of our realm and something to talk to ODOT about, or if that's who's building the bridge or the overpass. But in many cases, landslides in particular, hazard zones for earthquakes, etc., if you know the hazard is there, you have a fairly good idea of what you might expect. Many places it can be mitigated or it can be engineered for. But you're absolutely right when you go, like, you know, when you say it does cost money. You can't cut corners. You have to be willing to put the money into it to be able to fix or be prepared for whatever could come could occur there.
Yeah. Senator Morrison.
Are they still going to build a convention center by the Hatfield, under the bridge in Newport? I talked about that to someone down there, and they said, well, gee, we can engineer around that, but they're not going to do that.
Like it, no.
Madam Chair, that plan is currently on hold. I don't believe that's going forward.
Well,
you can ask Mr. Husing about it.
Well, the problem is, and the frustration that I've had when I've talked to people on the coast who are, you know, the planners and so on, they say exactly that. Well, yeah, there's a problem, but we can engineer, and we can't stop them from building there if they build up to the code. Are the code accurate? Are we doing a worst case scenario building code in some places? No, are we actually doing it? I don't know if we're doing it.
Senator Morissette and co-chairs, I can't answer directly for how the building codes for tsunami hazards. They have to look at our Senate Bill 379 line, which is the official state line for the overall coastal inundation. Now, how building codes incorporates that into their requirements for the buildings, I simply cannot say. Now, if certain buildings are to be built in the tsunami hazard zone, and some buildings are just restricted, you can't build schools in it anymore, you can't build emergency facilities, you can't build hospitals, I mean, that's pretty obvious, you wouldn't want to put something like that. Other buildings that that might be built there, if there's certain types of buildings, the developer or the owner has to consult with Dogami on mitigation for evacuation. We do not give any type of advice on engineering or construction. That's, again, far out of our expertise or realm. But building codes would be expected to be having someone review their engineering or their construction plans, I'm sure.
Thank you. One last question, Senator George.
When we were in Hawaii, you noticed in the hotel complex that they had designed that building to deflect, and they designed it for a pass-through. In other words, you had parking underneath the hotels up here. When we were down at the Wave Center at OSU, we talked with them about that, and they said, absolutely, most places in the world are making preparation as to how do we position a building. In other words, can you turn it 45 degrees and get the deflection? I mean, are we aggressively advising people that you may want to think about that kind of construction? Because you're going to have parking anyway. Why not put it under the hotel and put it up to where the wave action can go right through underneath, and the hotel would, in fact, sustain a pretty good tsunami?
Senator George and co-chairs, again, I think as advisory that may be discussed. Do we require that? I really don't think that
we,
that's
required. Do we know if Hawaii does? I guess I should have clarified.
And I do not know that, sir.
Okay.
Then they may have it. They may well have that in their building codes.
We'll have our committee staff check into that. If there are no other questions, we'll thank you very much for your presentation, and I'll assume that we can contact you if we have any further questions.
Absolutely. Okay. And, feel free to have a look at the summary that we gave you. It summarizes both The information that that James gave you, and also a few issues and some of the agendas that we have for this year to try to work on some of these. And thank you so much.
Madam Chair.
Madam Nelson.
Yes, may we please ask Mr. Riley if we could have copies of those slides?
Representative Nelson and co-chairs, yes, we did not want to make copies because we didn't know if everyone wanted it, but certainly
love
if
it.
You do, then we can make them available.
They're great. Thank you.
By PowerPoint.
Yes.
Good.
We'll call Director of Oregon Emergency Management forward, Ken Murphy. Welcome back to our committee. If you can introduce yourself and begin whenever you're
ready. Co-chairs Boone and Berger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Emergency Management for the State of Oregon. And I want to welcome the new members to this committee and thank those that I worked with over this last year during the interim session. I have no doom and gloom to give you, although if you want, I can provide a lot. And I won't assume any of the new members, you know certain things, so I want to give you just a basic overview of things and provide you some thoughts that might lead this committee towards some other things that need to be done. And I will tell you that I also do Homeland Security. That's another hazard that we face. And the one thing that I will point out as we go through this today is that emergencies, and you all know this very well, know no jurisdictional lines. They don't recognize any group, or they don't target any group. And for the most part, they can happen at a moment's notice. And one of the most difficult things that I've faced in my career in dealing with emergency management is convincing people to do something before it does happen. And I know the interim committee that we worked with, you know some of those stories of the challenge. And I know Representative Callan and her work on the coast and the 96 floods, a lot of things that you can do before it happens. But let me take you through these slides very quickly. Some of this is for humor. You must have some humor in the emergency management business. And the very first page is just some very simple thoughts, but I want to key you to the bottom quote, "Today's preparations will determine tomorrow's outcomes." I can't tell you how serious of a thought process that really is. And even the simplest preparation is important. Whatever this committee has talked about or will talk about, the very simplest of things can make a difference, even as simple as placing a new tsunami sign on the Oregon coast or, putting a preparedness message in the voter's pamphlet, which we have legislation coming on. Even the simplest things can make the difference of saving an Oregonian's life or a visitor to our state. On to the second slide, a little bit of humor. If you live here, you are at risk. We can't avoid that. We must accept it. But we do have the ability to try and change the effects of that risk that we deal with. And I should tell you, as we go through these here, in today's world, as it develops and changes, the risks become more, greater. Everything costs more. Current inflation rates, how we live in our cities, what we do, it becomes very expensive. This third slide is just a fact of life of how busy we are in our society today. And you all know as legislators that we have many issues that face us. Our constituents have many issues, the citizens, the visitors to our state. And a lot of times, we deal with those things that are emergent, that are important to us, that are our passions, and that type of thing. But that also leads us into this picture of this person with their head in the ground. It's one of the things, you know, I'm even guilty of this, you know, is when's the last time you checked your spare tire in your car to see, number one, was it actually there? Number two, did it have air in it? Number three, did you actually have the tools to change the tire? And then four, I suppose, you know, did you actually know how to do it? And you can, and over the course of time, you can always think about, well, it won't happen to me, it won't happen to my neighborhood, won't happen to anybody I know, won't affect me, or I'm just going to, you know, roll the dice, and if it does happen, I'll just be lucky. Dangerous situation to get into. But then at the very bottom of the picture of the person with their head in the ground is how prepared are you is probably one of the most difficult questions that any of you will ever have to answer. This country, let alone the state of Oregon, is trying to grapple that issue as we work towards homeland security and being prepared for terrorism, you know, and the nation, homeland security, and Congress owes the president a report in 2008 to try and answer that question. And a big question it is. Slide number four is just some very basics. Emergency management is found in ORS 401 and state law if you need to do any research. And my office is responsible to provide the governor an emergency service system and to deal with the mitigation, preparedness, response, and recovery as we deal with it, at least from the state agencies and trying to work with the counties and cities across our state. Now, in state law right now, counties must have a plan. Cities may if they choose. We have not forced them to do it, do not have the money to give them an unfunded mandate, but most cities have taken on the responsibility and recognize the issues, especially after the terrorist attacks and different events that have hit our country and this world. So we work very carefully. Now, just for a piece of the county emergency manager, and we do have one in every county, and quite a few cities have full-time emergency managers. If a city does not have an emergency management plan, it is that responsibility of the county emergency manager to help cover and work with those cities. On to the next slide, number five. This is just a list of the common threats that we face here in Oregon. We really try to think about everything, and these don't have to necessarily be something big and bad. The size of a disaster is not necessarily the determining factor. Sometimes we don't pay attention to the small things that turn into something much bigger. But these are just an idea of the things that we face here in Oregon, and obviously, you know, one thing that I did not put on here, and I hesitate, over the last years, we've had more occurrences of tornadoes. And so that might make it onto the list here one of these days. You know, we start to see more and more of those type of events that go on. And then the little quote there on the bottom right-hand corner, I always use that one a great amount of time, which I think makes me think every day, you know, why I didn't, but what's more worse is explaining it, why you didn't, especially when you're on camera.
Everyone knows your name.
And then page six of the briefing packet is just the phases of emergency management. And I put that in there for two reasons. One, for you to know the phases that I focus on, and two, to tell you the ones that I will always be passionate about. These are the ones that I will always try and get more money for and do, and that's mitigation and preparedness. We can prove across the nation for every dollar that we spend on mitigation, you save $4 on a recovery process. And so, you know, when you start using the word billions in a disaster, that turns into a lot of money. And to give you an idea of some of that, and some of you I know are familiar with these things, we had the flooding in Tillamook in early November that Senator Johnson had mentioned. We're doing assessments now of the December 14th windstorm. And one of the things that we'll work with during the windstorm is electrical co-ops that their lines were damaged by the wind or trees. And so what we will offer them, if we get the money to mitigate, is we'll offer them to bury those lines underground. And we've been very successful with that here in Oregon because every electrical organization that we've worked with where we buried them underground has not suffered a loss since then. Page 7 is a very simple graphic of a disaster in Oregon. It starts at the city level in the top left-hand corner of the slide. The disaster occurs, as you all know, first responders, emergency management, do their jobs at the local level. They may open an emergency operations center at a city level. If they cannot handle it, they run out of resources, they're overwhelmed, whatever the case may be, they can ask for help from the next higher level, which is county government. And very similarly there, the county government then provides its resources, its time, effort, and then if they can't handle it, things are still overwhelmed or the event is too large, then it comes to my office, and then we provide state resources and assistance. And in that process, there's a written declaration that provides the avenue so that we can ask for a presidential disaster declaration to bring in the next level of government, the federal government, to provide resources.
Thank you. I met Michael Chertoff at in Edmonton this summer, and Katrina was still hot on everybody's mind, and I think it still is. And I told him, I said, I'm from Oregon, and we got all these potential disasters out here. And he said to me, well, we can't, don't expect us to be there in an hour. He said, be able to take care of yourself for 48 hours is what he said. Mm-hmm. Are we using that as a basis for preparation here, or where does it trigger federal in case of some, biblical catastrophic kind of thing like Katrina or the tsunami in Southeast Asia?
Co-chairs Boone and Berger and Senator Schaffler, Secretary Chertoff, I think, became a true believer in a lot of senses after Hurricane Katrina, that there's more to this planet than terrorism. And we tell people, I think the standard that you've seen advertised across this nation has been a 72-hour kit. That's still a good idea, but we try and tell people at least a week to 10 days. And the simple fact of it is that there are not enough first responders, police, fire, emergency medical technicians. There's not enough state government, county government, city government, or federal government, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or Homeland Security to come to everybody's door. It just will not happen. There's just not enough of them. And I think there's a misconception after Hurricane Katrina, to some extent, that the Federal Emergency Management Agency is a first responder. Not true. They are there to provide resources to help the local governments get back on their feet. So the real, I think, productive piece of all of this is that continual education and training and exercising at the citizen level, that every person, their families, businesses, and government, take that responsibility to do what you can to be prepared, because there just simply will not be enough first responders to come, especially in the biblical catastrophe. I'll give you a little bit of doom and gloom. Dr. McConnell talked about the earthquake. Imagine the Cascadia subduction zone event happening. Everything from Interstate 5 West is destroyed, from Vancouver, British Columbia, to Crescent City, California. There is not enough resources and first responders that could get to you probably for a week. So, and that's just my personal opinion. Probably couldn't prove that, but I bet I'm not far from being incorrect. So, what we do as individuals is probably the most important thing that we can do for ourselves. And then you start building that, your family, your neighborhood, your neighborhood association, your community, county, state government, and federal government.
Thank you. Senator Bridger.
Mr. Murphy, I think that also there is a trauma involved that people in Oregon are not used to. If you saw the people in Katrina, they've all been through years of hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
And they are very accustomed, maybe not of their house being destroyed, but of knowing other communities where houses were destroyed. Not to the mass of what Katrina did, but they're not unaccustomed to that kind of tragedy at all. In Oregon, Oregonians are not faced every year or every 2 years with a disaster that psychologically prepares them for trees that are uprooted deep in out of the ground and people that need medical care in next door to them or roads being blocked. When I talk to my constituents, many of them think in terms of getting people to the hospital. They may never be able to get a person to the hospital. The roads may not even be there. So I don't know how you prepare people to get prepared. You might want to comment on that.
And Co-Chairs Berger and Boone and members of the committee, Senator Berger brings up a whole other aspect of emergency preparedness that, and I don't know this for a fact, my personal opinion, that maybe was not really addressed on a wide enough scale, but surely became apparent after the terrorist attacks in September 2001, and that's behavioral health and mental health, and how to prepare people, as Senator Berger said, and this is the good news and bad news story for Oregon. We don't have annual events other than forest fires and some minimal flooding that happens every year. And generally speaking, it's not that bad. And that's the good news. The bad news is we are not prepared for how bad it really could be. And I think I've been on a committee for about the last 4 years working on behavioral health plans. And I know law enforcement and fire and many organizations that deal with traumatic incidents, obviously the military, you have some very, very tough issues to deal with when you see people dying, their homes destroyed, and as Senator Berger said in Louisiana and Mississippi, it's not worrying about taking somebody to the hospital. Your whole city's gone. It's just not there. And I'm not sure states like Oregon are prepared, from the mental capacity of dealing with that. A whole other subject that bears, good discussion, because people do react differently in a time of crisis, and you don't necessarily, and I will add to that, even from the terrorist attacks, you don't necessarily. There were people watching the terrorist attacks on TV that suffered mental breakdowns. There were people in New York that were not physically affected by the actual destruction of the towers, but had a body part fly through their window, seriously affected mentally.
I have to say at this point, too, one of the things that you've brought up, there aren't, when you say it, when the big event happens, there aren't enough emergency responders in much of our state, especially along the coastline. It's all rural and it's all volunteer all the time. And those people are going to be just like you and anybody else. They will be getting to their families first, trying to get themselves together and organized. And they'll be making sure their families and them and their community, their neighborhood or whatever it is, are well set up before they go out and try to start helping other people. And that could be anywhere from what we've been told locally, 3 to 5 days. So it makes it more important than ever to people take responsibility for themselves and their close neighbors and friends who they can help if they're able to. So thank you. Go ahead.
Absolutely. No, and I just would add on to that, and I think Senator Johnson mentioned it earlier, is that balance between scaring people to death and living a good life and enjoying the state and the city that we live in. And that is always a challenge. On to slide 8, and I'm not going to go through every single one of these because I know time is critical and we can surely talk about this at any time, but I want to highlight a couple areas. Most of these are lessons learned from disasters over the last 20 years. And I will tell you, in the lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina, you can pull up the after-action reports from Mount St. Helens in 1980, and you'll see the same things that happened that weren't done or not done correctly. On page 8, the two things I want to highlight are the bottom two bullets, resource management and evacuation and shelters. Always a challenge with resource management. When you have a disaster, really of any size, but the bigger it gets, is how are resources used, managed. And, you know, when you think about it, and you're in a jurisdiction and you have 10 or 15 square miles of a city that's damaged, and you have people dying on one end, people dying on the other end of your city, or their houses are in threat, the management of resources to protect those people and their lives. And then,
Senator Johnson.
And listen, you talk about the management of resources sort of goes back fundamentally to who's in charge. We had a presentation earlier from the Department of Administrative Services talking about a big information technology project, and it went back ultimately to the success or failure of the project was who's in charge. And I think that recently with the Kim search, and I certainly know from my experience on Mount St. Helens, I was flying in a helicopter the day of the eruption, and we were being air traffic controlled out of the central part of the United States. They didn't have a clue what the terrain looked like. They were assigning altitudes at 14,000 feet for helicopters that couldn't get out of their own way at that altitude. And it all came back to who's in charge. And for some of these big, sexy disasters, everybody wants to be in charge. And I would hope that one of the things that we focus on is to get clear lines of communication about who is in charge. We saw it in Tillamook. How to get sandbags there, something that simple. And again, it boiled down to not having clear lines of who was in charge.
Yeah, Co-Chairs Boone and Berger and Senator Johnson's absolutely correct. That'll be an issue that you'll hear a lot of in this committee and probably in other areas. Who's in charge is important, and it can help you or hurt you on how that's done.
And we have a bill in that this is the bill that puts the OEM into the military department, and the bill about we'll be dealing with that. We've been working on this for the last year. Yeah, go ahead.
Before you take some, can I just follow
sure.
up?
Go ahead.
It would be very helpful, and I mentioned this earlier. I'm going to renew my request. It would be very helpful for those of us that didn't have the benefit of participating in your work during the interim to know the summary of what bills you have filed and a little bit of the history behind them that came out of the work of the interim committee. I guess I would like to see a level of detail, not between deciding where OEM sits in the military department or what, but literally how do you decide who becomes the incident commander on one of these things? Mm-hmm. Whether it's a tsunami, particularly let's take a tsunami where you've got an entire coastline affected. Ultimately, who's the incident boss? And I know that from flying on forest fires, there's a pretty aggressive hierarchy that decides who are area commanders, and it goes all the way down, and you do very elaborate change of command at forest fires. I don't really care where the function sits. I want to know when the whole world is coming apart, who's the one person who ultimately is charged with the responsibility of making the decisions, and are all the mechanics in place to get to that person and to have that person have the tools they need. I care less where they sit than to know who they are.
Well, I'll ease your mind a little bit. You, committee staff has delivered to your office last week a packet of information that has it's about a four-page summary of the
problem is it's lost in the ebb and flow of the tsunamis of paper in and out of your office.
Tsunamis of paper. I'm sure you'll get another one soon. Senator Morissette, could you just indulge Senator Berger just for a second?
Oh, thank you, Senator. Madam Co-Chair, I think Senator Johnson brings up an important point, though, and that is that I'm sure that this group needs to be brought quickly up to speed on what we did during the interim and the bills that are going to be coming through and
right.
what they will be faced with. And I think that, again, the point of who was in charge was a huge issue with the committee during the interim. And they struggled with it and wanted to be sure that someone was there that was trained and knew what they were doing and so forth. So I'd be very interested in your input after you see the bills that we have put in.
And they're in that packet. Most of them are LC drafts. They might have a bill. Some of them have bill numbers. There's three that are in the system right now. So
respectfully, it would be great to know where they are. Were they all introduced as committee bills? Just to know a little bit about the work you did this summer, so
it's
we
all
can.
There.
They're pre-session filed.
Yeah, they're pre-session filed. There are three in the system right now that I know of. There may be. Some I don't know if any have come back yet, but they're all Senate bills at this point. Two House bills. Yeah, they're moving along. So Senator Morissette, thank you for your patience.
Ken, who's in charge right now, this very moment? If the ground shakes, if there's a catastrophe, because it could happen any time, you know. So who is in charge?
Co-chairs Berger and Boone. Senator Morissette, unless the governor tells me different, I'm in charge.
You're in charge. Okay, that's what I thought.
And I take that role for any event.
Okay.
Even though I know at a local level there's probably an incident commander down at that local level. And to add to Senator Johnson's comments, and I won't take your time, but if you have any familiarity with how the fire business does incident command and how they work, the system that we use is modeled after that. Another result of the terrorist attacks of 2001, reemphasized during Hurricane Katrina, that everybody outside the fire community needs to be involved in how that management structure works. And it's so simple you can plan a Christmas party with it. The question is, will you follow it?
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair, respectfully, I might suggest that if you're taking invited testimony on this, it wasn't until after I had the privilege of starting to work with him that I discovered Commissioner Mark Labhart from Tillamook County was one of four people designated in the United States as an area commander for forest fires, meaning he would be flown anywhere in the United States where they needed somebody to assume the management of some of these giant conflagrations. And his comments on the successes and failures of that firefighting structure might be very useful. The other thing that I hope the interim committee took up, and I'm about now to reveal my bias, and I'm looking for Senator George to help me, is to make sure that as we contemplate our statewide response to emergencies, that we assure ourselves that we have the right tools. I think it is absolutely unforgivable that a state with a $40 billion plus or minus all funds budget doesn't have an airplane available to the chief executive officer. And I am not making a case for, and Donna would, I mean, Senator Representative Nelson certainly would second this. I'm not making a brief for the creation of an Air Force somewhere. We had that experiment, and it was not very successful. But it is simply unforgivable that we cannot dispatch the chief executive officer of this state, whether it's a man, a woman, Republican, Democrat, to the farthest corner of this state to be on hand in the face of some disaster. People in Pendleton have as much call to our chief executive officer as people in Portland, and I would think the sine qua non of any emergency management portfolio of responses would be we've got to have a mechanism to get our people moved around adequately, and that is not on the highway.
Well, Senator Johnson, I'll ease your mind once again on the Mark Labhart. Commissioner Labhart did speak to this committee and gave quite a comprehensive report on his fire experience, and we had him give a whole piece on it sometime during the summer, I think. So. And if it's helpful to the new members of the committee, I can ask the staff to basically give you the agendas maybe of all our committee meetings during the interim that we had, and all the issues that were addressed will be reflected.
I respectfully, Madam Chair, I would just say that that will help some of us from plowing ground that you've already plowed.
Yep. And that's we're very patient and happy to do that. And Representative Nelson, you had a comment.
Yes, thank you. I was going to concur with Senator Johnson since we've both been in the same business for many, many years in aviation, and I certainly agree with that. The fire procedures that are used, but The first work day after the first work day after 9/11, I found myself at down at our courthouse with our county commissioners asking, well, demanding, really, you know, where's our emergency preparedness? And really received very poor response. I'm sure I wouldn't get it again, and I'm glad those three are not there, and we have three very competent women commissioners now in that position. But, I was simply told that, you know, why do you need to know? And I said, I feel responsible for this county, this district, and I just want to know that we do have something in place, since I served on the County Budget Committee and the Parks Board as well as the Senior Transportation Committee, at which time I was told we do have a plan. But 1 year later, I was at a meeting with the same county commissioner who, at a church service, who apologized from the pulpit for responding to me that way, because we really didn't. We had such big egos that we let those egos come before adequate and proper preparedness. So since then, and we were just working on this morning, and my question was, of this committee, you know, am I, as a member of this committee, going to be held accountable for the safety of 3.5 million Oregonians? And that my answer back was yes. So we need to be sure that whatever system we have in place, that we have the right system and the right players. And then we go to the meeting of the Association of Counties, and we have no drills in the state. We have no connections. I took Yamhill County and the five states that surround Yamhill County and ask, how do we work together with those five other counties? Well, probably Clackamas and Washington are working with the other three and four around them. You know, how are we coordinated? We can't even get, 30,000 people through New Dundee. So how on earth would we ever evacuate Portland, and we're doing nothing about it, even though this legislature 6 years ago provided the funds to, provide a means for a bypass to get these people through? So I guess what I'm asking of this committee, Senator Verger and Representative Boom, is, have we defined, when we leave this house June 28th or whatever we're going to leave, or maybe March 30th, have we defined what we are going to be responsible for, what we're going to have in place? Because that helps, when we're dealing with ODOT and saying, what are you doing? How your part in this is, to clear us some adequate expressways or the aviation. That is a great issue. I want to know how we're coordinated with all the Air Guard. How are our bus system, our rail system, how do we evacuate all these senior citizens and these disabled? And my goodness, talk about something to learn from Katrina.
We have Representative Nelson addressed a lot of those in the interim. Mm-hmm. At, I don't know how many meetings. Jim, you won't know. Sorry. Mm-hmm. But many meetings. Yeah. A lot of that ground has been plowed, and we have Ken, Oregon Emergency Management. We have looked at all these things, our bills that have been pre-session filed were carefully honed down from a list of quite a few to address a lot of these things, but it is a big problem. It is a huge problem, and as he said, we don't have and we won't have all the resources that we would need in a perfect world, if we had this. So I can't promise you that we're going to do that out of this committee, but we're going to do the very best we can. And we all heard it. It's on the record that this is the man in charge.
Here,
Senator, I'm aware of the time.
A good comment is, how are we going to bring the people who were not on the interim up to speed? Now, that's got to
be. They're going to have to do a quick catch-up, and I don't know how we can force that.
Well,
but we'll provide them
with information.
We have the information available, and we got the report to the summary report to each office, and that does reflect the LC drafts that have been dropped, pre-session filed, and any in additional we can ask for. We can provide the agendas, and then if people need more information from there, Senator Moore said, if you have a great idea for that, that's...
Just that.
Well, and that, in other words, but I'm aware of the time. We've got one more presenter, and Ken's not quite ready yet or finished yet, so we'll go ahead and let him get on with his
presentation. I'll be very brief, and I want to give Mr. Housing time up here, and I won't go over each one of these, but... Co-chairs Berger and Boone and Representative Nelson, you're absolutely correct. And one of the things, and this is balancing how many things we have to do, but I can write you a plan that would bring tears to your eyes of how good we are. But if we don't test it, we don't practice it, and everybody, and we'll use the county, if every senior elected and appointed official in the county is not familiar with it, down to the lowest level paid employee is not familiar with it, it won't work. And that example applies to any level of government. It applies to the private sector. It applies to anybody.
I'm at the risk of taking one more half a second here. The state does provide services for mass casualty training drills that are either countywide or region-wide, and I've participated in a couple in my area of the state. So they do go on, and they provide training for a chosen disaster. And they, granted, they're not the big disasters. They're a bus wreck. They're a plane crash. They're things like this in the rural areas to try to get people together to... It's basically getting to work together, and it's along those same lines, but nowhere near the scope of the disaster that we're talking about. So...
Just a couple things, and I'll conclude my remarks. One thing that has always been on every disaster, it doesn't really matter how big it is communications. That's both using radios and two people talking together face-to-face. There's been failures there. And one thing, and I've talked to Co-Chair Boone about this, I think this committee needs to fully engage in the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. You've had, the interim committee had briefings on that, and very, very important. So communication systems are critical. The other one is leadership, chain of command, as Senator Johnson talked about, and knowing what the succession of command is. It's one thing to train the senior person, but having other people trained below you that know how to make the system work, know what the rules are, maybe even as simple as knowing how to write a check to pay for something. And that includes, you know, everybody. My last point then would be just preparedness, and that includes the committee here today, me, the people in the audience. One thing that will make us effective in this state is being personally prepared and our families. I clearly will need all members of the legislature. Something happens in a disaster, it's very important. And so if I ask you nothing more today, is your personal preparedness so that you can survive the next disaster and that you know that your family is safe. And last but not least, what I did with the joint interim committee, and I hope it will be all right, and I'm sure you'll tell me if it's not, I will email you things over time. There's very important pieces of information. I can always provide you, you know, a lot of information to help you, educate you or your staff on different issues. Emergency management touches every piece of our society. And so there's no subject that we can't talk about and how we can better prepare the state. My contact information is on the last page. Members of the committee that I worked with before know you can call me anytime. You're going to get difficult questions for your constituents. I can help you answer those questions when a disaster comes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And your emails have been extremely helpful to me to keep up with what's happening around the state and through your department. And I guess to answer the question, just read everything you get here in our presentations. Senator Berger has a comment to make before you go.
Yes, Mr. Murphy, for the last 2 years, there have been a lot of work and a lot of very sincere people working on the communication system. And it's very badly needed, and we all are very interested in it. But the $665 million price tag is sticker shock.
Yep.
I would really request that you try to help this committee in ways that we can have a good communication system that we can afford before we let it all go away and not be able to do anything. And so that's just my comment. I appreciate the work that the people have done, and I agree with you that we need one, but we've got to be realistic.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murphy. We will hear from you again. You will hear from us again.
I will be at every meeting.
Okay. And now we have Ono Husing from the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Association. Welcome, Ono.
Thank you, Chair Boone, Chair Berger. I know most of the members of the committee extremely well. I don't think I know. I've met Representative Nelson perhaps once very briefly and Representative Schaffer, but I look forward to getting to know you better. Before I get into tsunamis on the coast, though, you know, Senator Johnson, I love your comment about the airplane. One of my favorite days in the Capitol a number of years ago was I came here one morning and I went to see then Representative Messerly, and he bursts out of his office and he grabs me by the arm and he says, "Walk with me," you know, and we're going down the stairs and he starts telling me about the new Carissa. You know, there's a ship that's wrecked on the beach in Coos Bay, and, you know, right, you were mayor at the time, right? And we walk down the stairs, and he's telling me all about this. I'm going, oh, my God, oh, my God. And we get to the garage, and Senator Verl Tarno pulls up in his vehicle, and he goes, "Arno, hop in." And so the three of us get in the car, and we make a beeline for the airport right here in town. And there's the governor's plane waiting for us. Lindsey Ball was working for state police at the time. He, you know, basically opens the gate and lets us in. And, you know, and so the three of us flew. And, you know, with 40 minutes later, we're circling the new Carissa, you know. I mean, Senator Johnson, you fly all the time. But the idea, one minute you're sitting here and you're ready to talk about something else. 40 minutes later, you're flying over the wreck of the new Carissa, staring down. And then we went down, got to see the incident response as it was just happening. You're right. Right in the early days, you know, right in the early moments, the early 45 minutes to an hour of this thing, you know. And I think the governor had two planes at his disposal at that point or something like that. I couldn't believe it when we somehow let that go. And then we came back an hour or two later and we briefed the governor. He had a live eyewitness how things were going on the ground. By noon, we're back in the Capitol in his office briefing him. Yeah.
those planes are a long story for another time. All right, yeah. The philosophy remains the same. We ought to have an adequate plane that's adequately maintained, that's adequately piloted, that is appropriate to the mission, and I don't think we need to go back and rehash how we ended up with two public service beaters that we spent $1 million to rehab. But we need a plane.
Right.
I
think
I didn't mean to open any
message received.
It was deep where you stand.
I'd like to have a clarification from Senator Johnson. What do you really feel? How do you really feel?
I was trying to be good on the record here.
Okay, go ahead, Ono.
I know the hour's late. What realistically, how? When do you want to?
We end at 5.
We end at 5,
so
okay. All right, I spent a number of hours trying to pull together what happened since the Indian Ocean earthquake, the Banda Aceh experience, because as you heard earlier, that's the analogy for what we're looking at here. So I'm going to try to race through some of this, but I want to leave just a couple minutes. Obviously, this conversation is going to go forward. It's not a very good tale. In terms of, we got the ultimate wake-up call in what happened in Indonesia. And I've wrestled with this for a number of days. I thought we were going to make the presentation on Tuesday, and I want to be able to make this presentation in a way that does not seem critical of any state agency or any emergency manager on the ground. I have met with emergency managers for a while there. I became Mr. Tsunami. Even the governor called me that in his living room, because Paul Hanneman, a former state representative, right after the earthquake or the tsunami happened, he was our chair of OCZMA at the time, and he goes, calls me up and says, We got to have a tsunami summit. We got to figure out before we people on the coast, this is our situation, our threat. We need to make sure it gets done right. We need to make sure we have the right facts and that we control the situation, because we're the ones most responsible for people in our communities. Let's OCZ Nation call a summit, because our nonprofit works for the cities, counties, ports, and soil and water conservation districts in the Coquille Tribe on the Oregon coast. So Paul Hanneman, former legislator, calls me up and says, let's do that. So we did that. We got some grant money from DLCD. And again, that was the event happened, the Indian Ocean event happened in December 2004, okay? Right before you guys were coming back into session. Right before Congress was about to start a new session. So while the immensity of the catastrophe was hard to think about, I was saying to myself, as someone who deals with the Congress and you guys, was like, well, if it had to happen, it happened at a great time, because we're just entering these sessions and this is the ultimate, you know, teachable moment about the threat, and finally we're going to get the resources that we need, you know. So, well, what happened was we had a summit in March of 2005. We brought together 80 to 90 of the emergency managers on the county emergency managers, a lot of the police and the fire. So it was the pros. It was the people who ultimately are on the ground that are supposed to be in charge of acting regarding these things. We had Dr. Priest from DGAMI gave the briefings. We had a number of other people did briefings. And we ran through a tabletop exercise. You know what that is, right? That's where you actually role play what happens. And we had a woman that your committee really has to bring before you, Ann Steves, who now works on for the Samaritan Hospitals, but she does the planning, emergency planning for HRSA. We had a tabletop exercise, and Ann basically said, all right, it's 3:30 in the afternoon on a cloudless, sunny day on the Oregon coast, and the earth starts shaking, you know, and she starts asking the questions because she's got an emergency background. And so, are the lines of, you know, communication, has the public education happened? Bottom line is, we ran through the first minute to the first 5-10 minutes, all the way up through 10 hours, few days. Virtually every time she asked a hard question, the answer was no. You know, were the routes adequately marked? No. You know, was this there? No. It almost became comical. But what I loved about that meeting was it was absolutely complete honesty. You had all these emergency management pros that weren't going to BS each other in this a hotel here in Salem for 2 days. And it was very sobering. As we've heard earlier, the key finding was, though, that with a Cascadia event tsunami, because that's really what I want to focus on here today. It is such a horrific event. People need to know, first of all, if they're in a tsunami zone, after their warning is going to be the 5 minutes of being tossed around like a rag doll, and hopefully the building doesn't fall down on. So that's their warning, right? In Japan, they have a culture of preparedness. They've been through this enough. People need to know, am I in a tsunami zone? Do I live in a tsunami zone? Am I visiting a tsunami zone? So that's absolutely critical. If you're there when the tsunami hits, you're going to be dead. That was the central finding of some of these tsunamis. People don't survive these things. It's like a very bad air crash. Yeah, you hear the story of one person out of 150 in a plane, right, just miraculously coming through it. There were stories in Indonesia and other places where a wave threw somebody up on something. But no, people die in these things. They're absolutely deadly. We're facing a situation where literally tens of thousands of people can be killed on the Oregon coast. That's not an exaggeration. Try to wrap your mind around. That is very, very difficult. We learned also, though, that the central finding of that summit was the neighbor-to-neighborhood planning is the only way to get people thoroughly understanding what they got to do. Are you in the tsunami zone? How long will it take for you to walk from where you are after you've been through the quake to know where high ground is and to drill it? Yeah. In a few places we're doing that, where neighbors are getting together and they're going to see Mrs. O'Grady and seeing what she can get with her walker, where the kind of the safe thing is. It's all anchored, though, in the tsunami mapping. That's so critical. And DeGhani is doing such a splendid job. If Senator George was here, I'd compliment him on helping to build the Coastal Field Office, because he was really the father of that in 1999 when the Coastal Field Office was built. But those maps of the community showing where the lines are, so that people can at least get a grounding to say, am I in a safe place or not, is absolutely, everything kind of goes from there. So the mapping is absolutely key. We learned some stuff about the Indian Ocean event in terms of how big it was, and so some of the mapping needs to be redone, and it needs to be accelerated. I understand you have a committee bill, or you've asked DeGhani to give you an options package, right, a budget options package. That really, if you do nothing else, give DeGhani the funds to go out there and get those maps for the communities, the ones that they already have redone, probably slightly enlarged, and the other ones for not just the cities, but some of the fairly populated, unincorporated communities on the Oregon coast along the beach. Half the people on the Oregon coast live outside of a city limit in an unincorporated part of the community. So, again, all of western Oregon's going to be in ruins. So the other major finding was we went through this kind of like, so what's going to happen with the tabletop? When are we going to get help? And the emergency managers all in the room figured out back then, again, this is prior to Katrina, the fundamental finding was it's going to be a week, perhaps 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, because the Willamette Valley is going to be in ruins. The bridge is coming. Who knows what's going to happen to all those beautiful bridges on the coast. All the roads are going to be screwed up. So we really are going to be on our own for a long time. I'm carrying water today for a gentleman that I'd like to single out. Debbie, your constituent, Cannon Beach Councilor Jay Raskin, and Senator Johnson, your constituent as well. You probably met him already. Fantastic guy, was involved with this discussion that we had during the Tsunami Summits. Jay came to my attention. I've been working with him closely now for the last couple years. You know, Jay was a Portland boy. He got a degree in architecture, went down to San Francisco, was in that 1989 quake down there, developed a profound appreciation for what it's like to be in a natural disaster like this, moved back to Oregon, is now practicing his architecture practice in Cannon Beach, and he's on the city council. So there's a great story, and you should have him tell it yourself. And I'll tell you, in a nutshell, it goes like this. He met with FEMA a few years ago, and they kind of went through this routine planning exercise with him as a city councilor for a seaside community there in Cannon Beach. And his fundamental observation was the guys from FEMA says, well, you know, yeah, how many people you got in this town? Well, 2,000. Okay, that was the number of residents. I said, well, you need to kind of be prepared for 48 hours for, you know, 2,000 people. And Jay Raskin went, and says, well, on a average sunny afternoon in the summer and the spring and the fall, this town is 20,000 people. And the guy from Phoenix, I could just imagine what it was like, the deer in the headlights look like. Never thought of it. It's not on the script. You know, whatever. I'll spare FEMA any further commentary on that. But the gentleman basically said, there was a pause, and the hotels have to worry about that. You know, during the summit, we replayed that same scenario when Jay was giving a presentation. I said, well, Jay, you told me that the FEMA told you in a disaster preparing that it's the hotel's business to worry about all these people who have come to the Oregon coast. And in the front row was Bob Eaton, who at that time was running the Inn at Spanish Head in Lincoln City. And his eyes were like saucers, like, I said, Bob, you run the Inn at Spanish Head. Has anyone from FEMA told you that you're supposed to be responsible for all the people in your hotel? And he goes, absolutely not. I want those people out of my facility, you know. And here's a wonderful gentleman who's very interested in tsunami planning, and he was there at that conference because he cared, you know. That is also one of our it is a huge void that we do not have anything really in place. And I'm not trying to be critical of anybody, but it's... Yeah, I can sense some questions coming.
How much food does a hotel have on? How many days of food do they have on hand normally? Assuming they survive. Do you have any idea what that is?
No, I've never...
Most hotels on the beach don't have restaurants.
Yeah, I mean...
They really don't. You know,
and plus, are the buildings going to be... The other thing, you went through the scenario, was, can you even, would you even be allowed to go back into a building? Because do we have the people that can after an event like this, you got to have someone who knows something about whether a building's safe or not to go back into. We may have grocery stores or a Walmart there. That's just no one ought to go in there. Now, if you get hungry enough, you want to see people go into Walmart. Yeah, they'll go into Walmart no matter what the shape of the building was. But this whole post-event planning thing was again something that was, you know, sadly left out of our planning. So, you know, we've only got 6 minutes left. I thought we were going to get some help from Congress. You know, we had a outstanding work with our congressional delegation, and you know, I'll never forget watching Senator Smith, who is the head of NOAA, and said, to the head of NOAA, he says, well, what about, I understand from our people that we need tsunami mapping, number one, the state program run from NOAA, which is largely how the Dagami Coastal Field Office is funded. It's a little bit of NOAA money that comes to them that basically does all the great stuff that they do. And you should see how well received they are by the emergency management community on the Oregon coast. Thank God George Priest is there. Thank God John Allen is there. And now Rob Whittier is there. Three incredible individuals who all, by the way, have private sector skills that would be worth a lot more somewhere else. They care deeply about what they're doing. They work hard. They're providing us fundamental information in that program. But it's largely federal money that they have to sweat out whether NOAA is going to kind of piece it out to them each year, and they have to fight this, whether NOAA is going to put it all into these big buoys rather than provide the kind of money that we need on the ground and the communities for education and the mapping and all those kinds of things. When we came out of that summit, we basically, I really thought we would get money from Congress. I said, God, after something like this, after something like the Indian Ocean event, if you can't get at least some money from Congress to prepare, you know, when can you?
Do you have a summary report from that summit that we could?
Oh yeah,
it's
all written up. We've got transcripts and
well,
you know,
I mean just
probably,
a brief report.
You probably just need a butter, you know,
we would like
a bulleted.
If you have that would be helpful.
Well, you know, it's obviously a couple minutes to five, but I think what I would really want you to focus on in the committee, and you know, who knows what kind of, you know, some of you are on Ways and Means. We all know how hard it is for you. I mean, everyone comes to you in this setting and goes, oh, you got to fund my program. They don't tell you what else to cut or how to walk out of here with a budget, right? So I understand that, and that's a hard thing to do. But I think at least two things need to be put on the table in terms of immediate funding is to accelerate the Dagami mapping. We thought we might get that through the Congress, and it just didn't happen. Let's get Dagami getting those state-of-the-art maps out there. The other thing, Senator Moore said, you had a bill last session that talked about having information materials if you have a lodging facility in a tsunami, a mapped tsunami zone. there's something on your door telling you in a case of a fire how to get out of the building, right? Not very different than that. At least some explanatory materials. So if you we can give it to, maybe we don't even have to in the bill mandate, you know.
Well, no, all the motels are required to have that, and
they
rentals.
They have money.
No, this is local, too. There are
Cannon Beach has its own.
There are some local ordinances that require rental houses, apartments, and motels to have, in a very clearly stated area, mm-hmm. how to get out, where you go. It's very clear there's maps there of that area. Your first, you know, how to get to where you're supposed
to
go.
Well, I bet you Cannon Beach, I'm going to hazard a wild guess here because I've been rusty on the emergency management thing. This was so frustrating to be part of this, living and breathing this for 5 or 6 months, to see basically nothing happen, you know.
Well,
and so I bet you Cannon Beach is probably one of the only communities that has a local ordinance.
And it's not just Cannon Beach, it's Seaside.
Seaside's done a good
Seaside.
Job. Yahat, Seaside, Cannon Beach are real stars. Mm-hmm. And the other irony is...
Well, okay, my family and I, we get it with our shakes, we run up the hill, see the big wave. Now we're stuck there for 3 weeks with no food and water.
Mm-hmm.
Really, it ain't going to do any good to run up the hill. You might be better off just letting the wave take care of you and not worry about it anymore. I mean, if you're going to starve to death up there, how are we going to get food to these people?
You want to conceal carry from that.
You know, at our recent OCZMA meeting in Corvallis, we had a lot of local people together, and Jay Raskin raised this question again, and we didn't have an adequate time for discussion. I feel like it's like right now. And, you know, there was the discussion, well, maybe we need to have a room tax because this is a community that's definitely dependent on the lodging industry. Maybe there needs to be a room tax that gets a fund going. But think of the logistics are difficult. You know, you've got to have a container or a series of containers put in outside of the tsunami zone. Mm-hmm. That stuff's got to be changed regularly.
It's already in the works.
We're working on it.
Many, many, many of the communities on the coast and seaside, there's a statewide, what is that medical group that came and talked about the caches? Mm-hmm. So this is all happening.
Well, is it?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, I would submit to you that if someone as knowledgeable about coastal issues as Mr. Husing is unaware of what's already been laid in place, we're doing a bad job of getting the info out, much less to some visitor from Nebraska.
Mr. Murphy from OEM, I called Jay Wilson, who is in charge of tsunami stuff for Oregon Emergency Management, to get a fresh update. Because I ran into you on the first day of the session here, and I said, you know, we ought to really dust off some of those bills. And you said, well, I thought we had a whole bunch of stuff that's already put in place. You know, so I said,
well, may I?
Senator Rip Morrison.
For one thing, I don't know that we want to tell everybody where those caches are. Secondly, they're starting to be in place. The idea is that there will be medicine, food, that will be rotated, and they will be in certain places that are.
We have discussed this in the committee, and that is true. In a lot of cases, they're not telling people at large where they all are because they don't want them to be raided. They are managed by the local emergency responders.
Yeah, yeah.
Who know where they are, who know what they are. In some cases, I don't know where they are in my own area, but the chain of command does, and there's all been a plan. There's actually, and we'd have to go through our records, the actual name of the group. I remember Dr. Allen was here telling us about their deployment plan, where they all carry a GPS, they get the call, they deploy, they know where they're supposed to meet their team. So it's in place. It's in place. Yeah, Senator Johnson.
One final comment, and then I have to excuse myself.
We heard from
Lindsey Ball today that one of the principal things that you do to have a successful project is you plan. It seems to me that we have a very spotty baseline assessment of what exists on the ground right now. And I don't know how this committee can appropriately move forward if we don't know the status of what exists. Again, you all that may have been steeped in this for the last year or 18 months have the advantage of knowing. I find it interesting that Anna, who runs this not-for-profit, doesn't know. I'm the state senator from a district. I don't know where the caches of food are. Nobody knows what the management procedures are. At least some of us at the DS here don't know what the management procedures are. The guy with the keys family lives and everybody else. I don't know what exists right now, and it makes it virtually impossible to say, what do we need?
And Madam Chair, we heard testimony from Katrina, where people were literally thousands had not eaten for several days, and the food trucks came. Someone got their act together and had food, and it was out there, and they said to this person in charge, why aren't you serving these people food? They're starving. And she said, because we don't have any police. The police have to be here. We would have a stampede of people stomping each other because they hadn't been fed. So, you know, there's so much to think about in one of these crisis situations. I think that may be a little bit better organization after this session, after our bills get through. But I have to tell you, if that tsunami or earthquake or natural disaster happens this week, we're in trouble. Now, that's just my personal opinion.
If it happened last week, we were in trouble, too.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any? Senator George.
Otto, how many years ago were we talking about this? And I said, at that time, you could buy a really first-class container, 40-footer, for about $800 or $900. Let's get these situated at the Public Works Department. We have all of our food distribution to the needy folks, so you have a cycling thing. I actually talked to some folks from the Mormon Church and said, how do you do it? Give us the plan that you guys use.
Those are the kind of people to ask. Yeah,
and we had people that were, you know, when the district was part of my district, we had people say, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that's not going to work. And you're saying, yes, it would work. And you're, in other words, you have food coming in. It's being cycled back out to the needy people, so it's kept current. Many of the pharmaceutical stuff that we might need to have, or at least bandages and stuff like that, they're going to preserve forever.
I encourage this committee to work closely with Jay Wilson, who is works for OEM. Yeah. He's their tsunami guy. He, in fact, the Senator Johnson, he's the guy that has his finger on. He knows what's going on up and down the coast. He wrote the act after the tsunami that wasn't. Yeah,
I need to close this out. We're over 2 hours. So if there are no more questions.
Well, the conversation will continue. Thank you for having me here.
Thank you.